Hello, this is Kathleen, and today, Tuesday, June 9th, I'll be reading to you from the Daily News of Newburyport. State Opioid Report, Fatal ODs Drop to Historic Low, by Christian M. Wade, State House Reporter, Boston. The scourge of opioid addiction continues to affect Massachusetts. But new data shows the number of fatal overdoses dropped to historic lows last year. There were 978 confirmed or suspected opioid-related deaths in 2025, marking the first time the number of deaths have dropped below 1,000, according to a new report released by the State Department of Public Health. That's a 27% reduction in fatal opioid overdoses from the previous year and a nearly 60% decline since the state's record high of 2,364 deaths in 2022, the agency said. This projected decline represents thousands of lives saved, families kept whole, and communities strengthened, Governor Maury Healey said in a prepared statement. It also represents the tireless efforts of clinicians, service providers, community support programs, and advocates across the Commonwealth who continue to dedicate themselves to this life-saving work. State health officials heralded the new data as a milestone and said the declining number of opioid-related overdose deaths is a direct result of sustained statewide investments in prevention, harm reduction, treatment, recovery support, and community-based wraparound supports. Data shows us that providing access to housing, harm reduction, treatment options, and supportive peer communities works to prevent an overdose, and the Commonwealth will continue its commitment to supporting and expanding access to these tools and device services, Health and Human Services Secretary Kiami Mahania said in a prepared statement. Curbing opioid addiction has been a major focus on Beacon Hill for a number of years, with hundreds of millions of dollars being devoted to expanding treatment and prevention efforts. The state has set some of the strictest opioid prescribing laws in the nation, including a cap on new prescriptions in a 7-day period and a requirement that doctors consult a state prescription monitoring database before prescribing an opioid that's addictive. Millions of dollars are flowing into the state from multi-state settlements with opioid makers and distributors, including $108 million from a $5.5 billion deal with OxyContin maker Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family. Under state law, about 60% of those funds will be deposited in the state's opioid recovery fund, while the remainder will be distributed to cities and towns. The state spent nearly $28 million in the previous fiscal year on a range of prevention and treatment services aimed at blunting the effect of opioid addiction, the data shows. That included $3.4 million in harm reduction services, such as bulk purchases of the overdose reversing drug naloxone for distribution to local governments and community groups at subsidized prices, and fentanyl test strips that addicts use to test the potency of their drugs. Other funding went to expand medication-based treatments, such as mobile methadone delivery programs. Deirdre Calvert, director of DPH's Bureau of Substance Addiction Services, said while the 27% reduction is encouraging The state must never lose sight of the fact that behind every data point is a person, a loved one, a family member, a friend, a neighbor. Nobody is, and nobody and everybody has a somebody, she said. Our work is ultimately about people, about saving lives, and about ensuring that every person struggling with substance use knows that they matter and that recovery is possible. Nationally, about 70,000 Americans died of drug overdoses last year, nearly 14% fewer than the previous year, according to the preliminary data from the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It was the third straight annual drop in opioid-related fatalities, the CDC said, making it the longest decline in decades. The declining number of Americans dying from opioid overdoses also comes as the Trump administration has ramped up anti-drug trafficking operations with a focus on curbing the flow of deadly fentanyl into the country. Last year, Trump imposed tariffs on the nation's three biggest trading partners, Canada, China, and Mexico, citing the extraordinary threat posed by fentanyl and the country's failure to prevent the drug's flow into the United States. The president has also ordered strikes against Venezuelan drug boats and deployed more military in the Latin American region. We're operating at peak efficiency. Los Lobos to bring 50 plus years of musical depth to Gloucester, by Dave Gil DeRubio, correspondent. Founded in 1973 by high school classmates David Hidalgo and Louis Perez, Los Lobos has carved out a considerable niche for themselves as a quintessential American heritage band. For more than half a century, the quintet has built a legacy with a unique sound that leans heavily into a mix of rock and roll, blues, country, Tex-Mex, and soul, spiced up by healthy doses of Latin flavors, including cumbia, boleros, and norteños. For Steve Berlin, the new guy in the group, who signed on in 1982, the journey started with him being a fan caught up in the buzz Los Lobos endured after a legendary, disastrous experience opening for Public Image Limited in Los Angeles during the latter's 1980 tour. Berlin remembers the story well. When they did the Public Image Limited show, it was infamous, he said in a recent interview. During that era, they had long hair, long beards, and were wearing serapes. These weren't costumes. They wore what they would wear to a fancy folkloric show. So it wasn't like waving a red flag at a bunch of bulls. People went crazy at that first show, throwing stuff at them and spitting at them. You know, that whole wonderful punk rock experience. Nonetheless, they carried on, and it would be at a show Los Lobos played at the Whiskey A Go-Go that really caught the scene and Berlin's attention when he was still playing saxophone as a member of the Blasters. The first time Los Lobos played for real in front of people with electric instruments was the opening for the Blasters in 1980 at the Whiskey, Berlin explained. They'd shaved, cut their hair, and looked relatively like everyone else. It was kind of mind-boggling how amazing it was that there's this band from 15 miles away. They may as well have been from 15 galaxies away for how unusual it was. He said the experience was a memorable beginning for him. That night basically started my life in some respects, he said. That was the first time I ever saw Los Lobos. It was kind of a big deal for the Blasters and was basically Los Lobos' coming out party, even though the band had been together for 7 years, playing in East L.A. He wasn't in the band yet, but had taken advantage of opportunities to play with them. They very graciously let me produce a couple of things early on. I started with the By the Light of the Moon EP, and by the end of it, I was in the band, he said. That's why I'm not on the album cover picture, because I was still in the Blasters at the moment. It happened pretty quickly. Fast forward, and Los Lobos spent the last quarter of 2025 on a long, talked-about string of dates with longtime friends X, dubbed the 99 Years of Rock and Roll Tour. While this bill, featuring these longtime stalwarts of the late 70s and early 80s L.A. punk rock scene, had played dates throughout California in recent years, this was the first time these gigs had gone beyond the borders of the Golden State. Snafus with booking that Berlin was not at liberty to discuss wound up getting these non-California dates canceled. Nonetheless, Los Lobos members are leaning into a superpower they've possessed throughout a career that's found them topping the Billboard magazine charts, winning a handful of Grammys, and getting inducted into the Austin City Limits Hall of Fame. With a canon consisting of 17 full-length albums and counting, Berlin admits making set lists has become a good challenge, given the amount of material the band has recorded over 5-plus decades. We try to make it an overview as much as we can within the 75 to 90 minutes that we're doing, Berlin explained. We're not pretending to visit every album, but we're trying to do something that speaks to all of it and hope that people are happy in the end. He said his favorite songs are ones where we stretch out and there's room to screw around. Those are the most fun to me, he said. The Neighborhood and Mas y Mas. Depending on how we're feeling, sometimes they'll take an unexpected turn. For me, I always like when we venture off into the unknown. But we're not fish. It's not built in. Sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't. And depends on how we're feeling and so forth. I think that's the stuff I really like. As for what the future holds, there is a Native Sons documentary named after the band's 2021 all covers album of the same name, helmed by Doug Bluss, who edited 2013's 20 Feet from Stardom, and director of photography Pierre Justy, who shot the last several Los Lobos album covers. The film was supposed to come out 4 years ago, but finding money to bring it across the finish line has been the challenge. It's just hard to find funding for any art in the world right now, Berlin said. The way it goes with most documentaries, they started it without all the funding they needed, and now they're trying to finish it. My hope is that they'll see the light of the day. It's been the better part of 4 years that we've been waiting for it to happen. Doug and Pierre Bonafides are strong. It's not like they're amateurs or have not done it before. It's just really, really hard to find money. The editing and finishing are not cheap. It's expensive. We're hoping one day soon they say it's done and we should come watch it. Currently without a label, plans for recorded material from Los Lobos in 2026 are murky at best. In the meantime, the road beckons with U.S. shows on the books throughout the summer. The road is a place Berlin and his musical brothers are comfortable residing in for the time being. Obviously, every concert is a bit of a look back, because we're playing songs we've played before, but there's a bit of nostalgia, he said. But I think we're operating at peak efficiency and a chance for folks to catch us at the top of our game. I just know we're not planning to stop anytime soon. Go to the show, Los Lobos, Wednesday, July 22nd, The Cut in Gloucester. Thursday, July 23rd, Groton Hill Music Center. Saturday, July 25th, Narrow Center for the Arts. Visit https://www.loslobos.org/tour or other ticket outlets. As I See It, Imbalances Spike National Debt by Bill Ketter. The nation's financial prognosis is bleak as we move into the final months of the federal fiscal year. Spending continues to surpass revenue faster than a blink of an eye. Sadly, the White House and Congress have failed to come up with solutions to seriously reverse the slide into our debt quagmire. The gap between federal spending and revenues to pay for it was forecast in February by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office at $1.9 trillion for the 2026 fiscal year, ending September 30th. That will push the aggregate debt to an unimaginable $40 trillion. The CBO projected in February that fiscal year outlays could reach $7.4 trillion. The forecast occurred 6 months after the passage of President Donald Trump's tax reduction, Big Beautiful Bill, and 9 days before the Supreme Court invalidated $170 billion of his import tariff fees. The CBO estimated taxes, tariffs, and other income sources will bring in $5.6 trillion. That was more than 2 weeks before the start of the Iran war, which has increased the need to bulk up Defense Department spending, already a top cost item in the budget. Interest payments on the mountain of debt will reach $1 trillion annually. That's $2.8 billion a day, $1.95 million per minute, and $32,400 per second, according to the Peterson Foundation, the economic analysis entity devoted to America's fiscal sustainability. Interest payments might fatten the wallets of American and foreign investors who buy the bonds and securities from the U.S. Treasury to cover budget shortfalls, but it does little, if anything, to improve the economy. The unsustainable reality of mountain debt should loudly ring crisis bells across the land, but likely won't. Both major political parties deserve blame. Does the national debt get scant attention in the halls of Congress or candidate campaigns? When asked, most Americans say they want the president and Congress to focus on the national debt, but few voters truly grasp the enormity of the problem. So Washington customarily kicks the fiscal nuke down the road for future generations to defuse. But living in denial invites the inevitable worst outcome, insolvency. A new jolt is needed if Americans really care about the country's future. A constitutional budget amendment is one solution to give we the people a voice. It could require the federal government to stop constantly spending way beyond its means. That would require Washington to make the tough decisions on costs and revenue that lawmakers have been dodging for the fear of partisan backlash. Far-fetched? Absurd? Impractical? Maybe all three. Yet nearly all 50 states have some constitutional or statutory form of mandatory balanced budgets. That's why reductions in federal dollars move them to find state and local solutions to lost revenue. Amending the U.S. Constitution is understandably difficult. Just 27 amendments have been attached since the founders drafted the mother document 239 years ago. The first 10 amendments added the Bill of Rights 4 years later. There are two ways to amend the Constitution. Two-thirds of both bodies of Congress can vote to offer an amendment, or two-thirds of state legislatures can call upon Congress to convene a constitutional convention. In both instances, three-fourths of the states must ratify proposed amendments with legislative approval or ratifying conventions. Look at it this way. The national debt is an economic roadblock to the financial future of the country. If left unchecked, it will put an epic burden on tomorrow's young Americans who pay dearly for generational neglect. And even then, it depends on the young to be able or willing to pay. Bill Ketter is the Senior Vice President of News for CNHI. Reach him at wketter@cnhi.com. Newburyport PD charges Maine man with meth trafficking, by Dave Rogers. Newburyport. A Maine man was expected to be arraigned Friday in Newburyport District Court on methamphetamine trafficking and Class B distribution charges, hours after he was arrested by local police following a routine traffic stop on Story Avenue. Christopher Boyd Hawk, 47, of Fryeburg, Maine, was also charged with possession of a Class B and C substance, unlicensed operation of a motor vehicle, and a marked lanes violation, according to police records. At about 8:55 p.m. on Thursday, Officer Schuyler Riley noticed a vehicle with Maine plates cross the center line on Story Avenue. Riley stopped the vehicle near Convenience MD and soon learned the driver was operating on a suspended license. Hawk, who was arrested without incident, was held on $100,000 cash bail by police prior to his expected arraignment. I am always appreciative of the awareness and proactive police work done by our officers on a daily basis, City Marshal Matthews Simons said. This arrest by Officer Riley for trafficking illegal drugs reinforces our commitment to keeping Newburyport safe together. Newburyport Police Lieutenant Gregory Whitney said his officers confiscated about 169 grams of methamphetamine. Lowell's Boat Shop receives window restoration grant by Caitlin D. Amesbury. With some of its windows dating back to the 1800s, Lowell's Boat Shop recently received a $10,000 grant, which will be used to restore some of them as soon as this fall. The grant was handed out by Preservation Massachusetts, a Plymouth-based nonprofit in partnership with another nonprofit, the 1772 Foundation, with the organizers handing out $125,000 worth of grants every year. The grants are up to $10,000 and need to be matched by grant recipients. Graham McKay, executive director of Lowell's Boat Shop, said the boat shop's windows are in varying condition, with some being located in spots difficult to access, hindering their upkeep. So the windows themselves, some of them in certain parts of the building, are in rougher shape than others, mostly the harder to get to places. And so those have faced a lot of wear and tear. They probably haven't received much attention in 40 years, 50 years maybe, a lot of them. And they've held up extraordinarily well, and that's a testament to the wood that was used originally in them, he said. McKay also said some of the windows in question date back to previous centuries and attributed their wear and tear to weather. Some of the sills, especially on the south-facing side where they get wet, and then also the sun blazes on them all day, it is really hard on the wood itself, and these are old windows. These, I would assume, probably date to the late 19th, early 20th century. And this place is essentially a barn, so there's no storm windows to protect them or anything. They're just out there, he said. So McKay said he was grateful to receive the grants that will ensure windows at the boat shop can be restored. If you think about what it takes to maintain this structure, this property, and all that, that there are grantors out there that are willing to do that just makes it all possible. If it weren't for those kinds of funds, then our communities, especially here, would not be as beautiful. The historic properties that we value so much would be much more difficult to maintain, he said. Jessica Rudin Duba, Executive Director of Preservation Massachusetts, said Lowell's Boat Shop stood out among other applicants due to its mission and commitment to carrying on the historic trade of boat building. It's like a reinvestment into our historic resources. Not only are they being great stewards of the building, but they're also pushing the historic trades forward into the future, he said. And they engage with a lot of students and kids and families. And it's in alignment with our mission as well. McKay also praised Lowell's boat shop employee Pepper Wallace for her involvement. I'm very thankful to Pepper for writing this grant and having the motivation to do it, and also having the skill set to be able to do it. And it's all these little improvements that the general public doesn't see that keep these places from falling down around us, he said. Now the boat shop will need to raise the money to match the $10,000 grant, McKay said. And the work on the windows is set to be completed by this fall. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you all have a safe and well day.